American gun violence seen through Mexican eyes. Today on The World. I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman. There's sadness and anger here in America after yet another mass shooting. But in Mexico, people see a double standard.
They accuse us of being a violent little country, but look at them. Just one more mass shooting by a lone gunman.
Plus, a social media expert says we have to stop glorifying the gunman.
We keep playing the script for them. Instead of splashing the killer's face on all our screens, we should highlight the victim.
And for this Latino, both the Republicans and Democrats are flat out wrong on immigration.
It's a tough pickle for both parties, and they get through it by lying to everyone all the time.
Those stories are coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. Our program covers a lot of international news, and often we find ourselves describing the violence that's happening somewhere else on the globe. Or we report on countries that we describe as much more dangerous than our own. But today we find ourselves covering the aftermath of yet another mass shooting here in the U.S. I'm referring, of course, to what happened yesterday at a community college in Oregon. 10 people dead, including the gunman. And so many familiar questions about warning signs and the availability of guns. For some perspective on this, we turn to Alfredo Corchado. He's the bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News in one of those countries we often describe as violent and dangerous, Mexico.
I was on the Mexican side of the border in Nogales, Mexico, and it was interesting. I was interviewing people who had witnessed a shooting involving a U.S. Border Patrol agent who had killed a Mexican and shot him 10 times in the back. And then the news comes in, and we were talking about the United States. I mean, they seem so hypocritical. They accuse us of being a violent little country, but look at them. Just one more mass shooting by a lone gunman.
Does stuff like the Oregon shooting, somebody in a school shooting at students, does that ever happen in Mexico?
You know, there's been maybe a case or two that I remember, but nothing like the United States or nothing like Oregon or other examples in the United States. I mean, in Mexico, you hear about the mass shootings of immigrants coming through Mexico targeted by organized crime, or kids at a party in Ciudad Juarez who were had the wrong information and targeted the wrong house, but nothing like a Sandy Hook or in this case, Oregon.
Do Mexicans look at the U.S. and see a violent place?
A very violent place. And Mexicans, they take it very personally when the U.S. State Department warns Mexicans against going to such and such region or such and such state, and they point to places like New Orleans and other cities in the United States and say, you know, we're much safer than those cities. But again, you know, it's much more of a rule of law. It's much more of a question of impunity. In this case of the Border Patrol agent, he's been indicted. He's going to be tried, et cetera. And that's something that the Mexicans yesterday in talking to them said, you know, at least you guys have a rule of law where it, you know, there are consequences. In Mexico, you don't see those consequences.
What are gun laws like in Mexico? I mean, how easy is it to get a gun or an assault weapon?
Extremely difficult. I mean, Mexico has one of the tightest gun control orders or laws in anywhere. But again, like a lot of laws in Mexico, there and anything on the books, I mean, it's meant to be broken or it's meant to be ignored, again, because of a very weak rule of law.
How strict is the gun law? I mean, what does one have to do to get a gun?
You almost have to, you have to apply, you have to go through the military, the background checks, et cetera. It's extremely difficult. It's something where, you know, it's much more available through the black market. Obviously, the United States provides many of those guns that have been used by organized crime in Mexico.
What about issues of mental illness? That is a feature of many of these lone gunmen. Is there mental illness or mental health screenings in Mexico when one tries to buy a gun?
Yes, mental screening, background checks, all those kinds of issues that are being debated in the United States. I mean, those things are covered in Mexico. But again, you know, it's pretty easy to get around those issues.
How does the fact that Mexico have these strict gun laws and the U.S. doesn't, how does that change the way people in Mexico view the U.S. or does it?
Well, they view the U.S. as oftentimes as a bit hypocritical, oftentimes as a bit too easy to point the finger to the country south of the border and say, you know, you're corrupt and you're a bunch of killers, et cetera. And as this man said yesterday, you know, if you had a Mexican agent shooting at an American, you would probably have a U.S. invasion. On our side, we just kind of have to swallow our pride and go, you know, day to day.
Alfredo Corchado is Mexico Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. President Obama has long pushed to reform gun laws in response to shootings like the one in Oregon yesterday, and he did so again last night. Visibly frustrated, Obama urged Americans to push for change, much as other nations have done after mass shootings of their own.
We know that other countries, in response to one mass shooting, have been able to craft laws that almost eliminate mass shootings. Friends of ours, allies of ours, Great Britain, Australia, countries like ours. So we know there are ways to prevent it.
Sam Beeler studies gun violence at the Urban Institute's Justice Policy Center in Washington. Sam Beeler, as a news program that focuses on international news, we often describe other places as dangerous and violent. Where does the U.S. fit in globally when it comes to gun violence?
Well, Kiel, when it comes to domestic gun violence, the United States is certainly an outlier. We have not only a large number of mass shootings, but we also have a large number of single shootings and gun homicides that puts us on the higher spectrum of developed nations, indeed makes us almost unique among the developed world.
President Obama last night talked about other countries that have successfully curbed gun violence and mass shootings. Why can't we?
You know, at the federal level, I think there is a real challenge and a real resistance to making the kind of broad substantive changes that have often been suggested. For example, universal background checks. What that shouldn't obscure, however, is that at the state level, we are certainly seeing a lot of policy change. In this year alone, 8 states have passed new laws restricting access to firearms for domestic violence abusers. The real challenge now is figuring out how you translate some of that state momentum back up to the federal level.
Let's go to a couple of those countries that President Obama mentioned, Australia and Great Britain. What have they done to change the rate of gun violence?
So in both of those countries, what you see is that there is a really strict control regime passed in the wake of a particularly prominent shooting, and that's the Port Arthur massacre in Australia, where you had 35 people shot, and the Dunblane Primary School massacre in Scotland, where you had 17 people shot. And in both of those cases, what you wind up seeing is really an incredibly restrictive firearms regime passed, where you basically effectively outlaw private ownership of handguns, and you make it incredibly restrictive to possess things like rifles or shotguns.
And so that contrasts sharply with the U.S., where we keep having these high-profile incidents, and they don't result in anything at a national level.
Absolutely. I think that where it became particularly shocking for people was after Newtown, where you had 20 children and 6 adults shot, and I think people really expected that this might be the impetus for a larger national reform effort, as you saw along the lines of Great Britain and Australia. But that obviously did not come to pass, and I think that that's why you're seeing a lot of the frustration that President Obama evidenced in his discussion.
Do you think that Americans are becoming desensitized to mass shootings here? I mean, you know, Obama used the term numb.
I think that we've got a little bit of fight in us yet. If you look again at the state level, you can see that there is an appetite for reform along the lines of what many people are suggesting at the national level. Where it becomes particularly challenging in translating that state reform back up to the national level is that the demographics, the political environment from state to national change substantially. And I think that what we're going to hopefully see is that the long-term trends in political momentum in this country will hopefully shift towards more productive discussion about how we can prevent violence.
Sam Beeler studies gun violence at the Urban Institute's Justice Policy Center in Washington. Media outlets have named the gunman who carried out yesterday's mass shooting, but the local sheriff in Oregon has refused to do so, saying he doesn't want to give the shooter the attention he likely craved. Zeynep Tufekci has written about how the media responds to these kinds of incidents and about the need to stop inspiring copycats.
What you have is you have a troubled young man who's isolated, angry, aggrieved, access to guns, disordered thinking. So those are the elements that create the environment. And then they're seeking a distorted sense of infamy, some way of showing the world who they are, some way of getting the last word on their own terms. They look in the past and they realize killing a large number of people gets them just that, and it keeps happening again and again.
Based on what you have gleaned so far about the suspect in this Oregon case, any evidence that he's this type?
He is very much this type. And he even says on his blog, he says, look at these killers, referring to a previous one. I'm reading now his words. A man who was known by no one is now known by everyone. His face splashed across every screen, his name across the lips of every person on the planet, all in the course of one day. And he concludes, seems the more people you kill, the more you're in the limelight. So he was very aware of this media cycle in which mass killings, especially large numbers of people, got you that limelight. In the Virginia killing, the killer even filmed the murder. He filmed the snuff film and he got it on TV. So I think there's a definite cycle of publicity seeking troubled young men with access to guns, knowing what to do and playing out almost a script. And we keep playing the script for them, which is the part I wish would change.
You know, we're talking to you about this. Is this aiding and abetting? I mean, how does the media change how it covers these things to not encourage copycats?
Well, the recommendations aren't for censoring the news. The news is of public importance, but for reporting it differently. One of the things to do is instead of, you know, sort of splashing the killer's face on all our screens, we should highlight the victims. I went to people.com, which is this popular website about celebrities, just to see what they were doing with it. And the front page was his face, followed by a profile of him right next to Ben Affleck and Lupita Nyong'o and other famous people. I don't think we should do this. I don't think it adds anything to the story. We can focus on the victims and we can focus on the people who behaved heroically, which always happens. We can report what happened without details of the method, all the gun details, how many bullets, because that kind of concrete descriptions create a roadmap for the next person. Again, I'm not saying let's not report it, but with a very different focus. What does splashing a snuff film on television almost on loop? We don't need to hear their manifesto of a disordered thinking person. We can just be told he left behind a hateful manifesto. End of story. If we don't play in their own terms, I feel that we might have a chance at not inspiring the next person.
I mean, how does one even start? There's so many corners of the web. It's very difficult to rein in information if somebody wants it.
But we can not sensationalize it. We can not make these people famous. In fact, I often refer to the way the Western world has reacted to the ISIS beheadings, which were also a very similar event. Their killings engineered to go viral on social media and also to be sensationalized on mass media. The first time it happened with a Western victim, everybody shared the picture, the orange jumpsuit, the horrible last minutes, that it was all over my social media, it was all over television. But then there was a discussion and people said, wait, they're doing this to get publicity. And now when it happens, even on social media, I don't see it splashed all over the place. People instead share happier times of the victim's picture. The videos, these horrific videos, are archived on specialized websites that people can use. So I'm not saying let's erase it from history. I'm saying let us not give them the attention they crave on their own terms. There are ways to deal with this with more thoughtful analysis of how we're behaving, whether we're in mass media, whether we're on Twitter and we're wondering, are we going to click and share this? I think if as consumers and as media producers, if we change our behavior, we can have an impact on that.
Zeynep Tufekci writes about the intersection of technology and society. Thanks, Zeynep.
Thank you for inviting me.
Still ahead, how refugees are helping the local economy in Vermont. I'm Carol Hills with The World. Things got even more confusing this week in Syria's civil war when Russian planes started bombing parts of Homs and Aleppo. And as the conflict drags on, helping civilians caught in the conflict is only getting more difficult. Roy Musali knows that well. He runs a relief operation based in Damascus. It's called Quest Scope. They work in most areas of Syria not under ISIS or al-Qaeda control, including parts of Aleppo, where they coordinate food distribution in a part of the city. With a staff of about 300 across the country, they help about 200,000 people. Roy Musali joins me now. He's in Detroit today. Roy, give me an idea of what life is like on the ground in Syria. I just can't imagine what it's like to be living in a place like Aleppo right now.
In fact, in Aleppo, you might have electricity from time to time and water supply from time to time. So when there is water or electricity, you just stop everything, you rush and do what you need to do, your laundry, your stuff. But basically, life goes on. You try to respond to the needs of the people. You work sometimes when you have work, but basically, life goes on as much as possible.
So people are getting up in the morning and going to work and school and going on with their lives?
As much as possible. Most of the schools, many of the schools have been destroyed, but many more are still in action. All the displaced people are being put in the schools as shelters. So schools are still functioning as much as possible. And if people have work, they go to work when they can. You know, there are almost 8 million people who have been displaced and who are inside the country, compared to the 4 million Syrians who have left the country. And this is a total of 12 million who left their homes out of the 22, 23 million people of the population of Syria. So we have more than half the population that had to leave their homes.
When you're moving around Syria, do you find yourself sort of dodging, you know, barrel bombs or dodging kind of snipers or militia? Do you have to talk your way out of situations?
Sometimes, yes. There are always possibilities of bombs, rockets falling. There are always possibilities of going into dangerous situations, but until now, I've been spared and blessed.
Have you ever felt completely terrified out there?
When you see people who have come out of situations where they just were spared by millimeters from death, then you might say that it could have happened to you. When there's a bomb that explodes few meters from you and you are spared, then you would say, yes, I mean, it could happen anytime. So there are terrifying experiences, and especially when it happens to dear ones. But the fact that you are seeing life on a daily basis, on an hourly basis, given again and again, I mean, it gives us hope.
How do you stay neutral in this whole thing? I mean, don't you find yourself wanting one outcome or another, or supporting one group or another?
It is very difficult to be neutral in situations like this, and people tend not to be neutral. But when it comes to human suffering, then everybody is the same. Everybody is suffering, and everybody wants to be out of that situation. So if we focus on the needs of the people, on their brokenness, then we all discover that we are all the same, and all alike, all broken. We look like each other, and we really need to help each other.
Roy Musali of the Damascus-based Syrian relief group QuestScope. He spoke to us from Detroit. The Obama administration recently announced it was raising the number of refugees admitted to the United States each year up to 100,000 by 2017. It's primarily a humanitarian move, but as the world's Jason Margolis reports, admitting more refugees can also be a boon for businesses and local economies.
At the Coffee Cup Bakery in Burlington, Vermont, they produce 480,000 donuts a day. Human Resources Manager Judy Shraven shows me around.
So right now he's running pumpkin. So we do a lot of seasonal donuts.
Once they're cool, donuts stream down a conveyor belt where workers quickly pluck off six and box them up. It's repetitive, tedious work. Starting pay here is $14 an hour plus benefits, which is at the high end for lower-skilled workers. The employees making donuts and bread here are refugees, mostly from Nepal and Bhutan. Shraven says they've helped the company's revenues grow 30% annually for the past few years.
So without the refugee workforce, we would not have been able to succeed at the level we've been able to succeed.
Can you find people who aren't refugees? I mean, if you post an ad, do people answer or no?
No. It is actually almost impossible to find non-refugee workers that are willing to work in the manufacturing environments.
Vermont has an older, declining population, and the state has the fourth lowest unemployment rate in the country. So many local companies are tapping into the refugee labor pool. To do that, they turn to Eric Duffy. He's an employment counselor with the Vermont Refugee Resettlement Program.
The demand is much higher than we can supply at this time. Almost on a daily basis, we're getting phone calls from new people trying to work with us.
Some refugee arrivals in the U.S. are placed in Vermont. Others choose the Burlington area to follow family. Besides jobs, refugees need help finding housing and health care. Families need schools. And then there's the language barrier.
Let's look at these words and repeat them after me. Fast.
Fast.
Sweet.
Sweet.
Sherry Starr teaches a level 2 English class in Burlington. Besides vocabulary challenges, refugees are learning to understand how Americans speak.
In the United States, our T's become D's. They won't say better. They will say better. So you have to listen for those T's.
Those classes are provided for free through the Vermont Refugee Resettlement Program. Well, free for the students. The organization's parent, the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants, receives 91% of its funding from government grants, i.e., our taxes. Each refugee also gets a one-time payment of $925 from the federal government when they arrive. Bill Kerr at the Harvard Business School says you can think of the economic argument for or against admitting more refugees this way.
There's a short horizon and a long horizon. In the short horizon, the public is going to have to play a financial role.
Eric Duffy with the Vermont Refugee Resettlement Program quantifies the short term to about 4 months. He shows me some recent data.
This is fiscal year 2014. 92% of them were self-sufficient.
Self-sufficient means having more money coming in than going out. People can pay for their rent, food, and utilities. And they're contributing to the economy, says Bill Kerr at Harvard.
They're going to start paying taxes, consuming goods that are going to help the manufacturers and services in the country. They're entrepreneurs. They're going to create new businesses that will employ workers.
Joe Carton has seen that in Vermont. He's the chief operating officer with Westport Hospitality, a hotel management company. He hired his first refugees, Vietnamese workers, in the early 1990s.
The next generation of Vietnamese, have they own businesses, they're going to college, they are pillars in the community. So it's really an exciting story.
He says he'd welcome an influx of refugees from Syria or wherever. Last year, Vermont only took in 317 refugees. Carden would gladly take more.
They are dedicated, they're loyal, they come to work every day. If they don't come to work, their mother comes to work.
And he says bringing in more refugees doesn't just make business sense. He thinks his state, which is 94% white, could benefit by becoming a little more culturally diverse. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis, Burlington, Vermont.
You're tuned to The World. I'm Carol Hills. The immigration debate in America is nothing new.
Those who can contribute most to this country, to its growth, to its strength, to its spirit, will be the first that are admitted to this land.
But who said it and when? The answer, plus a tune from a business major turned musician. Ahead, here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International and by Soundworks.org, offering perspectives on events and cultures around the globe with The World's Daily Podcast and the Studio 360 Podcast. Subscribe at Soundworks.org or iTunes.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Immigration is one of the big issues in the current presidential election campaign. On the Republican side, Donald Trump is leading the way with lots of tough talk about deportations and border walls. On the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton's pushing a plan to expand the path to citizenship for immigrants. This isn't the first time our politicians have debated these sorts of issues. In fact, tomorrow marks the 50th anniversary of the law that held helped transform America, the Immigration Act of 1965. Here's more on that from Saul Gonzalez of station KCRW in Los Angeles.
About every month, something really big happens at the LA Convention Center. Thousands of immigrants file into a cavernous hall to participate in a mass citizenship swearing-in ceremony.
Please stand and come to order.
In this one, more than 6,000 people from 140 nations are becoming new Americans. They're from countries like China, the Philippines, Armenia, and Iran. Diversity you wouldn't have seen in a citizenship ceremony 50 years ago.
Before 1965, we had an explicitly discriminatory admission policy for immigrants coming to this country.
Hiroshi Motomura, a professor at UCLA, is an expert on U.S. immigration history. He says for much of the 20th century, immigration laws favored admitting white Western Europeans into the U.S., but made it very difficult for people from other parts of the world to settle here and eventually become citizens.
Back in the 1920s, Congress decided that it wanted to preserve the ethnic composition of the United States as it existed around the turn of the 20th century, in other words, around the year 1900. And so it basically set quotas or limits on the number of people who could come from certain countries.
It was called the National Origins Act, and it restricted immigration from Eastern and Southern Europe, Asia, Africa, and the Middle East in favor of Western Europeans.
So this was very much a quasi or perhaps pseudo-scientific view of immigration, that if we let in the right people, not only will this country maintain its ethnic composition, but it will somehow lead to a better, more intelligent America.
But after World War II, there were calls to reform racist immigration restrictions. And 50 years ago this month, President Lyndon Johnson signed into law the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965. It would have enormous consequences for America.
And this measure that we will sign today will really make us truer to ourselves, both as a country and as a people.
That's President Johnson speaking before signing the act at the base of the Statue of Liberty. The act abolished the old race-based immigration quotas and replaced them with a system based on immigrant skills and family ties with U.S. citizens. Again, President Johnson.
Those who can contribute most to this country, to its growth, to its strength, to its spirit, will be the first that are admitted to this land.
And to this land they came, new immigrants from new places, and as they arrived, they changed America. It's after 1965 that American cities like Los Angeles become cities of new immigrants. Here's a striking comparison. In 1960, there were 6 million people in L.A. County. Nearly 5.5 million of them were white. Now, only about a third of L.A.'s population is white. It's also the place with the largest number of Filipinos, Armenians, Ethiopians, Thais, and Koreans outside of their countries of origin. William Min remembers seeing and living the demographic changes.
When I first arrived here, there were a total 1,000 Koreans living in Los Angeles metropolitan area.
Min's a lawyer and lives in L.A.'s Koreatown neighborhood. He's 82 and came here from Korea in the 1940s. His father was a diplomat. He remembers when Koreatown had few Koreans and how that changed after the 1965 law.
Suddenly, I walked down the boulevard, then I start hearing Korean conversation, and that was a big surprise to me. And then I saw handwritten commercial signs pop up on the little store windows, and Korean items were being displayed.
So you were seeing and hearing kind of the first seeds of the Korean-American community being planted here.
Yes, yes. That was a very exciting surprise.
But the 1965 Act also seeded future immigration challenges. While it lifted immigration restrictions from many parts of the world to make it politically palatable, it actually put the first quotas on immigrants from Mexico and Latin America. That compelled many people to cross the border illegally. Again, Professor Motomura at UCLA.
What it did was say, okay, we're going to end the formal discrimination, but that means we're going to treat all countries the same. But treating all countries the same meant now, for the first time, we're going to limit Mexican immigration.
That helped create what we have today, over 12 million people without lawful status in the U.S.
Oh, say does that star-spangled...
But back at the citizenship ceremony in L.A., the debate about current immigration laws seems far away. These people, coming from all points of the compass, have this in common. They're eager to start their new lives as Americans. For the World, I'm Saul Gonzalez, Los Angeles.
For a lot of Americans, even those whose family came to this country a long time ago, immigration is an issue that hits close to home.
People, I think, are very confused by that. They want to know why Mexican Americans who have deep roots in the U.S. like I do, multiple generations of U.S. citizens, why we consider this our fight. It is our fight, and we're not done waging it.
Ruben Navarrete is a columnist with the Washington Post Writers Group. He says Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump has created quite the stir with his hardline comments on immigration. But the truth is, Navarrete says, that Trump's views are right in line with most of his GOP colleagues.
Many of them have signed on to the idea of building some sort of a wall or structure along the U.S.-Mexico border, something that is easier said than done. And some number of them are also talking about, if not rounding up people and deporting them, at least speeding up deportations. And the funny thing and the frustrating thing about this, it's not just Republicans who do this. Also, Democrats as well favor deporting people. They've actually done it. Barack Obama deported a record number of people. And both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton voted to build a wall along the southern border while in the Senate. So, you know, it's not just for Republicans. Democrats do it, too. Those are two very popular ideas.
But you write also that the Democrats kind of play both ends of the street in how they talk about immigration, or at least they talk about it one way and deal with it another.
That's true. Democrats need the votes of both organized labor, where they get a lot of money. Organized labor typically is opposed wider immigration, broader immigration reforms, because they fear competition with foreign workers. But Democrats also want to please Latinos who want immigration reform. Republicans, on the other hand, want to please the Chamber of Commerce, which wants a ready flow of workers, and the nativist wing of the Republican Party that wants fewer. It's a tough pickle for both parties, and they get through it by lying to everyone all the time.
So you've been good at dissecting these hypocritical views and teasing out the contradictions. But do you have your own prescription on what is the answer for fixing the system? You acknowledge that it's much more complicated than both parties acknowledge. Do you have your own kind of policy idea?
Yeah, it starts with the idea that George W. Bush has a framework put out there, the three-legged stool of a guest worker program, where we finally get over our national pride and admit that there are jobs Americans will not do at any price. So we bring in some number of foreign workers to do those jobs. Then it has more border security, but not in terms of more Border Patrol agents, which even the Border Patrol doesn't want because it can't train them all, but smarter technology on the border, tunnel detection equipment and the like. And then lastly, some plan to allow not all of the 11 million to stay, but some of them to stay. Don't make it a cakewalk. Make it very difficult for people to get to legal status, not citizenship, but legal status. It's right down the middle. It's the best way to approach this. But I will say this, the debate that nobody's having, that it's coming full force, is what to do about legal immigration, legal immigrants. That's really the tough one. How do we make the decisions about who comes into the country legally? Do we go after high-skilled workers? Do we preserve family reunification laws? What is our plan, really, for dealing with folks who want to come here legally? We still don't know.
And, of course, it's the 50th anniversary of our current system of immigration, right, which is largely about family reunification. How would you like to tweak that, if you could?
First of all, you have to understand that the 1965 Act was a corrective act. It was necessary at the time because what we had on the books before that, the 1924 Immigration Act, might as well have been called the Italian Exclusion Act. It was to keep people out from Italy and from Southern Europe, which was code for Italy. And it instilled these horrible quotas that said basically you want to bring in more people who are English and Irish and keep out people who are Italian. That had to be done away with. So the 1965 law brings in a whole series of other quotas and webs, and it brings in a family reunification provision whereby you, if you get in, you can bring in all your family members. That now, I think, has become a disaster, and we need to stop emphasizing family reunification in favor of demand. If you need nurses, bring nurses. Don't bring engineers, you know, just because they have better SAT scores. Getting into the United States should not be like getting into Yale or Harvard. If you have a demand for nurses, bring in nurses from the Philippines or somewhere else.
Which has been done, which was in fact done.
Yeah, and it's a smart policy. But typically the right wing has it wrong because they think getting into Harvard should be like getting into the United States, and we should take high-skilled workers and give them all a test. And so, you know, you want to take doctors and not nurses, even if you need nurses. That's stupid. But the left wing has it wrong because they want to emphasize family reunification as the guiding principle, which I think is not fair either and not right either. So we should really emphasize our demands and our needs and go after people we need.
Ruben Navarrete is a syndicated columnist with the Washington Post Writers Group, and he's also a columnist for The Daily Beast. Thanks so much, Ruben.
Thank you.
Earlier this week, there was news of a gruesome murder in a village in northern India. A 50-year-old Muslim man named Muhammad Akhlaq was killed by a lynch mob. The reported motive? Rumors that his family had been storing and consuming beef at home, angering Hindus in the village. The cow is considered a sacred animal by many Hindus. It's a case which has shocked much of India. The World's Ritu Chatterjee says it all started on Monday evening.
There was a gathering in the local temple, and there was some sort of an announcement made that somebody had seen the Akhlaqs kill a cow, and that immediately sort of mobilized the people at the temple, and about a group of 50 people, mostly young men in their 20s, rushed to the house of the Akhlaqs. They banged on the door. When the family opened it, they dragged the father and the son out, beat them with bricks. And the father died soon after as a result of the beating, and the son is still in critical condition.
Why would eating beef be so provocative to Hindus in this village?
It's not just in this village, Carol. It's all over India, and more so in some of the more conservative pockets. Eating beef has been an issue for many years now, and it keeps coming up every now and then. But it has been becoming more of an issue this past year. We've seen a beef ban in the state of Maharashtra, where selling and possession of beef was made illegal earlier this year in March. And there was a ban on killing cows, and that ban was extended to bulls and bullocks. Food has become, in this past year, increasingly political. It's not just about beef. We have seen a war over eating eggs, where the chief minister of another state, Madhya Pradesh, tried banning eggs in daycare centers run by the government, which is for very, very poor kids, where the egg is the only source of nutrition. Vegetarian versus non-vegetarianism is becoming kind of an issue. And beef, of course, because it's sacred for Hindus, has increasingly become an issue.
What has happened to the perpetrators of this murder? I mean, has anyone been arrested?
Yeah, six people. The last I read, six people had been arrested. The police were still on the lookout for others. But the interesting thing here, Carol, is that, you know, you mentioned that the meat, which the family claimed was mutton, which is what we Indians call actually goat meat. The police actually took that meat from their refrigerator and has sent it for forensic analysis. And the question here is that, well, what if it was beef? You know, how does that justify taking a life? And why has the police even bothered to send that meat for analysis? But, you know, on the other hand, the police has made some arrests and is apparently trying to make more arrests here.
Now, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi is himself a Hindu nationalist. Has that fact emboldened other Hindu nationalists around issues like diet and who's eating beef and who's slaughtering beef?
Well, that's what critics of Modi, opponents of Modi would say. I have to point out that Prime Minister Narendra Modi has remained silent on the matter. He has not issued any statement. And I have to point out that other BJP leaders, since this last incident on Monday, have come out and sympathized with the sentiments of the mob.
That's pretty incredible. What about the wider picture? I mean, how divided are Hindus and Muslims still in Indian society? Does it come down around sort of, you know, economic status, or how does it play out?
It plays out, Carol. Whenever a political party decides to use this as an issue, you know, I have been to parts of India where, you know, Hindus and Muslims live perfectly comfortable with each other. And then I've, you know, visited places where I've heard a lot of Hindus talk very openly against Muslims. So there's been a mobilization that has been happening over time, particularly through social media.
The World's Ritu Chatterjee speaking to us from Delhi. Thanks, Ritu.
Thanks, Carol.
By the way, Ritu was involved in our recent coverage of women's rights in India. As part of our Her Rights series, we teamed up with BuzzFeed India to talk with women and men about sexual harassment. We spoke to comedians, actors, and radio personalities, and we made a couple of videos. Our latest one looks at harassment from the point of view of Indian men.
Just look at every film from the late 80s right through the 90s. It's all about harassment.
If a hero
asked a girl out and she said no, but he consistently for a year kept harassing her, and the girl's like, okay, fine, you're so persistent. The guys are like, oh, all I need to do is just keep annoying the shit out of her every day.
Stop showing your kids Indian movies. You make them watch Friends. Friends is nice.
Watch our video produced in partnership with BuzzFeed. It's called How Not to Be a Sexist Jerk in India, and it's at PRI.org/womenslives. Coming up, a musician from Mauritania who got his big break courtesy of Peter Gabriel. That's ahead, here on The World.
The World's Global Nation education coverage is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, part of the American Graduate Let's Make It Happen initiative, supporting communities as they work to end the dropout crisis. AmericanGraduate.org.
I'm Carol Hills with The World. They're called Iraq's Forgotten Lair. They're the women who work as prostitutes in Iraq. Many get lured in, traded for small sums of money, and abused. Journalist Rania Abusaid has spent time with some of them, and she actually has some good news. She met a woman who's secretly trying to help vulnerable women caught up in Iraq's sex trade.
She was a former victim of sexual violence, and after she was prostituted, she was pimped, and after many years of working in this trade, involuntarily initially and then voluntarily, she found herself in prison, and she decided to turn her life around because she saw, you know, a lot of violence. Some of the women who were picked up with her were executed, and she just decided that this is enough. I need to change my life around. I need to get out of this criminal world of prostitution and violence. And she is an incredibly brave woman who works to try and map out what is happening in Iraq and to try and, you know, she presents this information to Iraqi authorities via intermediaries. And, you know, she and the intermediaries told me that often this information is simply ignored. But she's told me on more than one occasion that she sees this as her life cause, that she is absolutely determined, regardless of the personal violence that, you know, she is often threatened with, because it's a very dangerous job to sort of, you know, move undercover and pretend that you're a pimp or pretend that you're a retired pimp, in her case, to get access to these brothels and to get into these nightclubs and have the kinds of relationships that she has with pimps and prostitutes. But she's nonetheless absolutely completely devoted to this cause.
You accompanied her as she tried to get information, and she was sort of undercover as a pimp herself. What did you observe her do in order to get information?
One of the reasons why she can do this is because she was in the trade many years ago. So she has those sorts of connections, and she mines those connections. So she's a known quantity, if you like, in this underworld in Iraq. And she taps into those connections, and she uses them to expand her network, and to also, you know, it gives her a degree of street cred, if you like, with these people who she's dealing with.
Can you give a couple examples of the kind of women or girls that are finding themselves in the sex trade?
Well, it's mainly women and girls who don't have the support of their families, either because they're fleeing from their families because of some sort of domestic abuse, or they've been displaced and their usual family network isn't around them, so they're in an alien environment, if you like. And, you know, one of the young ladies in my piece found herself in a very rough neighborhood because it was cheaper, and it didn't take long for pimps, and they are women in this trade, for one of these pimps to find her and to offer her free shelter, free food, a sense of stability. And that's how she was lured into this trade.
You just mentioned that many of the pimps are women, and that really surprised me. How does that happen? It's so different from at least our image of how prostitution and the sex trade operate.
Yes, it's a very different model to the sort of, you know, Western stereotype, if you like, of the pimp, the male pimp who sort of controls the women. In Iraq, and actually in much of the developing world, it's these are criminal networks that are run by women, but there are men behind them. There's quite a tangled web of men behind them, and corrupt police and militia men in the case of Iraq.
Is the current Iraqi government doing anything about this?
Well, in August of this year, the Women's Affairs Ministry, which was always a ceremonial body anyway, was actually closed down as part of government downsizing. And that was one body that was supposed to sort of advocate for women's affairs. And it was shut down.
How did the U.S. invasion of Iraq affect the sex trade? How did it affect the demand or the situation for women who now find themselves in the sex trade?
The women I talked to didn't want to say that it was better under Saddam, but that it was more of a mixed bag. It was better in the sense that there was a state, there was a security, it was a brutal state, and there certainly were crimes that were perpetrated against women during that period. But now, with the degree of lawlessness that was prompted, precipitated by the fall of Saddam Hussein's regime, the rise of very conservative religious clerics and parties who are that are trying to take over, have a greater say in personal matters, the rise of militias now, after, you know, we've got Islamic State on one side, and then we have a plethora of militias that have come up to face that group. And according to Human Rights Watch and others, they say that some of these new militias are no better than the Islamic State that they face. So it's, you know, the challenges are many.
Rania Abu Zaid is a journalist covering the Middle East. She has an article in The New Yorker about the sex trade in Iraq and a sex trade survivor who's trying to help women and girls in it. Thank you so much, Rania.
Thank you.
Finally, let's end the week on a joyful note. And for that, we turn to new music from singer-songwriter Dabi Touré. Touré is a former business major turned musician. Born in 1970 in Mauritania in northwestern Africa, a move to France as a teenager allowed him to try his luck in the nightclubs of Paris. His big break came when he opened for Peter Gabriel on one of his world tours. Dabi Touré is now on his own solo tour. He's playing tracks from his new album, A Mon Affaire, or Once Upon a Time. Tune is called Oma. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Marco Werman will be back on Monday. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. Have a great weekend.
Is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH. Brought to you by PRI's Global Reporting Fund, supporting its diverse reporting efforts, including ongoing global health coverage and its Across Women's Lives initiative. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Garrett and Cecilia Boone, the Gruber Family Foundation, Lynn and Bruce Dayton, and the Harold Simmons Foundation. By the Skoll Foundation, supporting innovative solutions to the world's most pressing problems with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship at skoll.org. By the Ford Foundation. By the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs. And by the PRI Ambassador Council, including Linda Larson and Jerry Johnson, the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Noor Hall. And by the National Endowment for the Arts.
PRI, Public Radio International.